Welcome to Big Blend Radio's Military Monday Show with Mike Guardia, award-winning author and historian. So happy New Year, everybody, and happy 2024. Happy New Year, Mike. It is good to have you back on the show. Are you ready for another year of military history? I'm sure you are.
Yes, ma'am. Always good to see you, Lisa. Thank you for having me.
Hey, this is going to be fun. We're going to talk about January 1966 Vietnam military history. Because, of course, today this is airing on January 1st. But we're going to look at January, wind it back to 1966 and talk about some of the events that happened early in the month of January back in 1966. And I think this ties back to your latest book that is out now, which is Fire in the Hole, Tales of Combat with the 1st Engineer Battalion in Vietnam. So it does tie into that, doesn't it?
This history. Yes, ma'am, sure does.
Yeah, I was reading about this history. So this is, and everyone, that book, Fire in the Hole, is out now. It came out in December. It is ready for you to read, whether you get it on Kindle or hardback. Go check it out. Go to Amazon.com and get it there. Or I've got the links in the show notes, or just go to MikeGuardia.com and click on his Amazon link from there and get it. And I love it because you really, you know, we talked about this last month about the combat engineers. And today I know we're going to be talking about Operation Crimp. And I don't think this operation would have happened without the combat engineers, right?
That's right. Yeah, the combat engineers, they really played a critical role in how that whole operation unfolded, especially since you had a lot of organic engineer missions happening to expose and secure the entire Viet Cong tunnel network that was in that area.
And with this area, so this was kind of like in South Vietnam, right? This is by Saigon. Am I getting my mapping right here? So we're near Saigon where this operation happened.
Right. It's not too far away from where Saigon was. And if we wind the clocks back to January of 66, we're looking specifically at the 8th of January until the 14th of January. And the center mass of the operation happened in a place that was about 12 miles north of Kuchi, and it was a critical operation for us at the time because that was one of the big Viet Cong headquarters, and we knew that the enemy was elusive, and we knew that they were making some use of these underground networks, but we didn't know just how sophisticated they were and how deep they ran. And one of the things that was a big yield for us in Operation Crimp was not only discovering one of the biggest networks of these underground tunnels that the Viet Cong had, that not only they had built and built upon, but it also was an incredible intelligence bonanza for the U.S. because it gave a lot of actionable intelligence to include, you know, names of rosters and a lot of locations of weapon caches, things that dealt a very heavy blow to the Viet Cong operations in that part of South Vietnam very early in the war.
So when this happened, Operation Crimp, the other thing that I thought was interesting, and we touched on this last month, and actually I don't know if it was on air or us chatting, but it was when Australian troops worked with the U.S. And that's something you really rarely hear about Australia being part of Vietnam on the U.S. side of things. Now, growing up in South Africa, we always heard what the Australians did, you know, because they were so close. But this is something unique for folks to kind of realize how America worked with Australia on this.
Right. You know, I think that it's something that doesn't get a lot of press coverage, you know, even in a lot of the popular histories of the conflict. People seem to forget that the war in Vietnam was not just an America going it alone operation. It really was an allied effort. In fact, if you look through a lot of the old press releases and a lot of the stories that were circulating about the Vietnam War during its early years, you constantly hear you constantly hear all of these references to Allied forces. Allied forces did this. There was an Allied patrol that uncovered this. You know, very rarely was it just characterized as a U.S. patrol. It was very rarely characterized as U.S. forces are doing whatever. And people forget that not only was it the Americans who were in Vietnam, but you also had Australians. You also had South Korean troops there. You had many of our former wartime partners from World War II and Korea who were there side by side, of course, not in as great of numbers as we were, but you made very significant contributions to the war effort as a whole. And in particular for Operation Crimp, you had the 1st Battalion of the Royal Australian Regiment, who many of the American veterans who served alongside these Australians, they say really these guys were on par with our own special forces. You know, that they were very tough, they were very resilient, and they embodied almost every popular stereotype that you hear about Australians. You know, some of them have looked back and said, you know, try to imagine Crocodile Dundee in uniform, you know, going off in the jungle to fight the Viet Cong. And that's pretty much the situation that you had.
Well, let's talk about these tunnels because that's, the Vietnam War was insane because, you even think about World War I, then going to World War II, there was a Korean War, and then here we go. And Vietnam seems so like in World War II, we had like the Japanese that were like, you did not want to be caught, right? It was the Japanese were not cool and certain parts of, you did not want to be a POW at that point. But then when you get to Vietnam, it seemed like that kind of thing could happen too. If you were a POW, a prisoner of war, for the Viet Cong, couldn't you? That could be pretty brutal, but they also understood their jungle, better than what Americans would kind of know. I mean, unless you came from Louisiana or from, Crocodile Dundee land in Australia, they were pretty sneaky from what I don't, from what I know, and that's little. But they seem very sneaky in understanding their terrain, which is, like a whole, it's a different world, right? And so doing these tunnels, that was something unique to be able to find these tunnels and, get all the ammunitions. And I think they even found like hoards of rice so they could actually, for US and Australian troops, they could get some extra food there, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly. It was really quite an impressive discovery as far as Allied forces were concerned, because they didn't really know the extent of these tunnels and how far they went and just really how elaborate they were. And you know, in the course of exploring all of these tunnel networks, especially in Cu Chi, they found, okay, well, some of these have been recently built, but a lot of them are extensions of tunnels that were built from previous conflicts. You know, for instance, you know, things that were put in place when the Vietnamese were fighting the French and even fighting the Chinese. So they said that the tunnels themselves were very well done, and surprisingly enough, they were very well ventilated, but life in the tunnels really wasn't all that great. You know, for the Viet Cong, you know, they often had to live with, they have to live with all of the creepy crawlers that you would expect to see down in subterranean levels. And many of these tunnels were infested with ants. You know, you'd have insects like venomous centipedes, snakes, spiders, all different kinds of rodents. You know,
Ew.
most of the Viet Cong
That's
soldiers,
just
they would
ew.
spend the day in the
No.
tunnels working or resting, and then they would come out at night to scavenge supplies or tend to crops or you know try to take out as many Americans on a nighttime patrol as they could. And yeah, so you really had a lot of Viet Cong soldiers who were swapping their days and nights. They were essentially becoming these night shift ambush soldiers.
Wow. Wow. And that couldn't have been easy for them either on the other side to be doing that. You're burning the candle at both ends and it's traumatic. And that can't be easy. But then, here's the your opposing side, American and Australia, hey, we're going to go in here and do something new. And I was reading that, there were five U.S. soldiers that were called the Black Lions that were killed going into the tunnels. The Black Lions. I don't know how they get their names, but they were listed on a site. I was reading about this, and it was interesting because it seemed that the Viet Cong had snipers. So as they were just tell me if I'm getting this right or wrong. So like as our troops, American and Australia, are finding these tunnels, the Viet Cong had snipers like pick them out as they were going in. Am I getting the right picture on that?
The Viet Cong, they had snipers everywhere. They had a sniper. They also had an early incarnation of IED bombers and roadside bomb triggermen.
Oh wow. So that would be like your mines, your landmines. That are going to go off
Exactly.
as you go through. Wow. I can't, I listen, Mike, I still can't get over that story you told us that's in your book, your Fire in the Hole. I was telling Nancy, I'm like, dude, you got to finish this book because this is insane. The story about the gentleman with, getting his leg blown off and then still going for a cigarette through the mines, the explosives. Like, I'm going to turn around and go back where things are blowing up just to finish my cigarette. Like, I still can't get past that story. People, you got to read Fire in the Hole. This is insane stuff, man. I can't get past that. Have you been able to get past that story yet and like
No.
figure it out? It's just still blowing my mind. And you're reading about all, when you read this history of Vietnam, I mean, it just seems such a difficult war. And like when you're talking about, rodents and ants hurt, man. I know about ant bites, man. They are not funny. And you can get infected with ant bites pretty easy just from scratching. But when things go bump in the dark, like, come on, that's kind of, you could blow stuff up just because of that. It's just like, what was that? Boom. what I mean? So I wonder, like, how much of that happened too in the war in Vietnam, where, just out of like, what the hell was that? That things would go off, because of things you're not used to, or bugs and rodents and snakes, and you hear something and then you just shoot, because that's pretty much your instinct, right? To just do that. Do you think that happened a lot? I mean, that's going to be a usual for war, right? Is just blow it up if you don't know.
And it was especially traumatic for the soldiers who were over there, especially during those first few years of the combat mission, because they really didn't know exactly what the enemy was doing from one day to the next, and they knew that they would use the night to their advantage, especially to try to make diversions and try to emulate sounds of the local wildlife to try to trick the Americans the best they could, try to psych them out. And it gets tough because you don't know which things that are going bump in the night belong to the enemy and which one of them belong to Mother Nature. It does lend itself to a lot of, hey, if something moves or if it's making more noise than you think it should, yeah, you go ahead and shoot at it. And there is a story that kind of dovetails into that. Actually, two stories. One, which was early on in the deployment for Charlie Company, when they were over there, and they would have these probes from the Viet Cong throughout the night along the perimeter, and it was a situation where if they had a lot of movement or if they had a lot of noise coming from one particular side of the perimeter, they would open fire with every available weapon that was on that side. They would fire into the darkness until until the noises stopped.
Wow.
And then other times they would go out on an ambush patrol. And well, I say ambush patrol. It was really more. It was really more of an observation post and a listening post where they would, send out a squad of troops to occupy a certain piece of high ground, and they would just sit there and listen and lie in wait and see if they could draw any kind of enemy fire. And
Wow.
you know, and some nights you would go 6, 12 hours and you wouldn't hear anything, you wouldn't have any enemy contact, and then you would just go back to your home base. But then other times you would get enemy contact, and even if you would go hours without making any positive identification of the enemy, when you would exfil from wherever your OP was, you would throw out a few hand grenades, and you would fire off a few you would fire off a few bullets into the darkness of the night just to try to kill or throw off anything that might be following you.
Wow. Wow. Well, you got to do what you got to do,
Exactly.
but I just think like Vietnam's creepy. There's a creepiness to it. I mean, I know people have to vacation in those areas and everything, but there's a war creepiness to it, like where you just don't know what's coming out because it is swampy, it's tropical and you don't know. And like you were saying, on the last show about Vietnam is like the soldiers thought they could trust certain women or people, and then they would turn around and turn on them. So, that could that lead to a sniper knowing where you are? As a soldier, an American Australian soldier, that maybe you met some girl or something, everything's, woohoo. And then next thing like that led to a sniper attack on you or a
Yeah.
different. Wow.
Well, yeah, if any number of the South Vietnamese call girls were on the Viet Cong payroll, a lot of them would go out to any of the local GI bars or any of the places that American troops were known to frequent or known to patrol through. Yeah, they would just go out and act all friendly, act all coquettish, and maybe within the course of any number of liaisons or just any friendly conversations, that'd be a ripe opportunity for a suicide bomber to make his move, or for a sniper to set up a position, and just take any targets of opportunity you could.
I was reading about the 28th Infantry Regiment, the Black Lions that were killed
Oh yeah.
when they were searching for the tunnels. I was like realizing like we've been to these places where they are from, and they are listed in the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in D.C. And you see all these names when you go to a memorial, but you really don't know what they did sometimes. And I appreciate the memorials for sure. But when you start to kind of have that, you think about someone coming from like Overland Park, Kansas, which we've been to every year so far, over the years here, part of Kansas City, and then Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And you start to look at where these, Lafayette, Georgia, when you start to know these areas, then you start to think like that you just went through night and day territory. I mean, that's to me amazing. I don't think Milwaukee looks like Vietnam, So you've got to think in how young he was, 18 years old. Michael P. Moran, a private first class that passed. It's like that was young, 18 years old to be sent over there. I was a brat when I was 18, like. You know what I mean? So you got to think. I mean, there were two of them were 18. One was 33 from South Dakota, 34 Warren, Michigan. I mean, These were all young men in the line of fire, and yet, this was going beyond playing military games at home, I don't even think we had, video games right back then, right? We didn't,
No.
very much, so this was like a whole other world and reality. And that's what I want people to understand. And these are young guys that went out there, whether drafted or putting themselves out there on the line. And I mean, that how did we help them get prepared for this war, do you think, from the American side, not just for Operation Crimp, but were we prepared? Was the U.S. military ready for this war? I mean, are we ever ready for wars? Like, we can look ahead as much as we can now, especially it's a little easier, maybe not, I don't know. But for Vietnam, was this like a big, uh-oh, we don't know what the hell we're doing, but we need to go in when we did?
From a tactical standpoint, I think our troops were about as well prepared as they could have been. And I also think that I think that tactically speaking, we actually had the edge over the Viet Cong because when I was speaking to a lot of the veterans who had deployed with Charlie Company, they were very quick to tell me that they got a crash course on the culture and the language of Vietnam. That they were pretty well versed in the language and the customs. They generally knew the history of how the Viet Cong came to be and what they could expect as far as their fighting tactics and also the tactics of the NVA, because a lot of it was drawn and inspired from the latter day Soviet tactics, which a lot of us already knew a lot about at that point. So I think tactically speaking, we were in as good of shape as we could be. I think where we went wrong was just not having a clear understanding of what the strategic outcome was going to be. Because if you look at the battlefield performance of, how we did in Vietnam, even during some of the qualitatively worst years of the conflict, you look at the if you look at the body counts and you just look at how we conducted ourselves in the field, there's no question at all that we won every battle. And, we mopped up about 2 million, we mopped up about 2 million North Vietnamese in total. And we did this at a comparatively low cost of 58,000 men. Not that that's a trivial number, but if you just look at the kill loss ratio, there's no question at all, really, that we came out on top. But because we didn't have a clear strategic picture in mind, and we left the latter day peace establishment and the cyclic security enforcement to the South Vietnamese Army, they weren't really in a position to where they could handle that level of responsibility themselves. To say nothing of the fact that you had several parts of the South Vietnamese military structure that were unabashedly corrupt and not very tactically competent in what they were supposed to do, and just not really motivated, for lack of a better term. And, when you take those things together, those latter things that I mentioned, the unclear strategic parameters, the hamstringing of all of these personnel and HR policies, yeah, it's going to make for an army that can perform very well in the field, but is really just spinning its wheels because there's no long-term picture in sight and no way to secure the peace long-term after you win it.
Wow. Well, it's important for people to realize all that, to understand. And that's the thing. I mean, for you going in and interviewing these veterans from Charlie Company, for you, did you learn more than what you do in research from reading than when you're actually
Oh, yeah.
talking to veterans? You start to have a deeper knowledge, about what is or isn't. What we all sit and watch on TV or headlines and do just generally as human beings isn't necessarily, what we think is happening is not necessarily always the truth, right? Until you talk to those who are actually there. personally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's
It
what you
really is.
deliver in your books. Yeah.
I love the opportunity to engage the veterans and interview them because they add such a richer dimension to it. You know, getting these personal stories down on paper, and I know that they have their liabilities. I know that, you know, I know that as the years go by, and as you know, and they get more and more removed from the immediacy of the situation that they were in. I know that memory can and often does, you know, it will eventually distort and rearrange the facts of what happened. And it's not that they're trying to deliberately deceive anyone. It's just, you know, memory is what it is. And, you know, sometimes you just can't remember things as sharply or as coherently 30 years after the fact, whereas, you know, you could recall it with a lot more clarity and a lot more coherence if you're just a day removed. But getting those stories down and getting all of the veterans to tell me what happened and matching up the sequences of their events and just getting that personal dimension, it makes for such a richer historical experience, I think, than, you know, reading something out of what I can only call a colloquial textbook.
Right. Here's your timeline. This and this happened, but you have no emotion of understanding of what war is. You know, I love that you tell the people stories. And you know, people's memory fades. I mean, and it happens at all ages, quite frankly. You know, it's just like how much, you know, like Nancy always says, my file cabinet's full. I'm gonna have to dump something out of the file cabinet to bring more memories in, you know, and remember them. And you know, the reality is I think we always remember what our soul story is, if that makes sense. Like you, it may not be the exact year, but who really cares? I mean, I suppose it's important, but that stuff is documented. But it's about the story of how you felt and what was it? I mean, even just talking about those rodents, here you are in these tunnels, and like next thing you know, a rodent jumps on you. I mean, come on. Like that, we're all freaked out by that. You know what I mean? It's those kind of things get you, the things in the middle of the night. But if you're at war and you're supposed to be sneaking around and doing things, it's like it's crazy. And so your memory may be focused on that moment more than on this date we invaded this. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, we did this, but all I could think about that rat was going to bite my toe or something crazy like that, you know. But that's the reality, isn't it? Like that's the thing about actually having that communication and getting those stories so people understand what war is about and what soldiers, men and women, have gone through over the years. And Vietnam is just, it's a wild war and so much controversy of people arguing over it and fighting over it and not being, you know, nice to the soldiers coming home from Vietnam, as we talked about a couple shows ago. And, you know, Nancy gets all riled up. You know, she's not allowed on the Vietnam shows anymore. She gets busy, and she, for rightly so. You know, she was in high school when this was going on, and also lost a lot of friends. So it's very difficult to think when you lose people, especially at a young age, and you're grappling with understanding who you are at that age, yet you're losing friends in a war that you don't understand, and everybody's, you know, not everybody, but your half your town is, you know, spitting at them. That's not an easy thing to talk about, not nicely anyway. It's not. So I'm really, you know, Nancy and I both are grateful that you are shining a light on this, because I think we're a little slow on the uptake on Vietnam, understanding that, just, you know, we're now starting to really see more about World War II, World War I, but and I still think we're slow on World War I. We barely have that any history out there, you know, stories for us to understand. I just think the spotlight should be a little bit more. But and you've done a great job on World War II, and but Vietnam, I think those veterans, you know, we're at the baby boomer age now, and that generation needs to be honored as well. Do you feel that writing that? Did you feel pretty propelled, like, to do any more stories on Vietnam?
Oh yeah, I sure do. You know, I think that I think that it's I think that it's good these days that our Vietnam veterans are starting to get the recognition that they deserve. And, I mean, I really credit that with the good strides that have happened over the past 20 years in no small part, because of what Hal Moore and Joe Galloway did with their book. But, I really want to keep that momentum going forward. I want to, I want to get more Vietnam stories down on paper, especially since we're at a critical point in time when I think that, our Vietnam veterans are, rapidly approaching the age that our World War II veterans were at when we started saying, okay, well, these guys are going to die off soon. And we need to preserve the legacy of their stories. Because as of right now, I mean, the youngest of the Vietnam veterans is right at 70 years old, and it's not going to be too long before these guys start to pass away in record numbers. A lot of them, the ones that haven't passed away already due to the number of health issues with like Agent Orange or any number of the any number of the any number of the chemicals that were fired off over there. They need to be honored for their service, and they need to know that the hostility that they met coming back, that that's not going to be the lasting legacy when they finally leave this life,
No, it's true. It's true. I'm glad we have the memorials too, though. But I want things for those who are here now, so that they aren't forgotten. It's like, don't wait for the artist to die to buy the painting. You know what I mean? Yeah, or the book, by the way. get the book now, but it's a true thing. It's I want to also bring up, because we're talking about Vietnam, Henry Kissinger, who recently passed away. And I really, I mean, I didn't grow up here, but I did not know how complex his story is. It's like a complicated relationship. People love and hate him for reasons. And I remember when the day he passed on Facebook, I'm like, holy cow, people were like, it was like he was being spat on by a lot of people, and some people were like, rest in peace, he did this, he did that. So, like, what the heck did he do? Like, and Nancy even was like, was he still alive? I mean, he was like, what, he was about 100 when he died or something? Like, he was up there. No, that was Norman Lear, was like 100 too. Like, Norman Lear passing away was bad, though. That sucked. That Norman Lear. Well, I mean, that goes and ties into Vietnam history. He covered that, like in All in the Family. He really shared what the country was doing, and I don't think you can get away with anything that Norman Lear did then now. But he did show all sides, I think, and that was an important piece of American pop culture history, what he did. But I remember him and Meathead fighting on All in the Family about Vietnam. About wasn't that it? Yeah, it's a yeah. When you think back now, we have to go back and look at All in the Family. That there's a way to start off your new year. But Kissinger, that was interesting to see. And I was like, Nancy, Henry Kissinger's dead. And she's like, is he still alive? I'm like, well, no, he just died. But you know what I mean? And then I said, wow, people are calling him like a killer and a murderer. And I'm like, she's like, what? And war criminal, war criminal. So there's the Watergate stuff, but the war criminal, can we talk about what was going on there, why people are calling him a war criminal?
Yeah, and it's kind of ironic that people would call him that because he actually came over here to the U.S. as a way to escape war criminals. Yeah, I think a lot of people forget that Henry Kissinger was born in Germany. He was born in Germany after World War One, and he came over here to the U.S. in the late 30s as a Jewish refugee, and he was on the run from Nazi Germany. And he wasn't here but just a few years before he enlisted in the army, and he went over to fight the very people that he had escaped from. He also he said that one of the things that he was proudest of in his life was serving in the army, and going over to going over to fight in Europe, where he could not only be a translator, but help some of his former countrymen get back on their feet. He said that his experience in the army really made him feel like an American, and he really wanted to pay that forward, give his service to the country that that granted him freedom. And how he paid that forward was he said, well, I think probably the best thing that I could do is get involved in government and get involved in also get involved in politics. Now, if we fast forward to the late 50s, he's working for he's starting to get involved in some of these special studies, under the Rockefeller Foundation, and he's also doing work for various think tanks like the RAND Corporation. He's in the he's in the Office of Operations Research, also in the Department of State, and he was also a big admirer and a big contributor to the Rockefeller family. And he I think a lot of people forget that he worked on the presidential campaigns for Nelson Rockefeller. And he was active,
Wow.
through he was active in Republican politics all throughout the 60s. And when Richard Nixon ends up getting the win, that's when he comes in, and he serves first as a national security advisor and then as Secretary of State under President Nixon. Now, for him being a killer and being a murderer, well, it's just not that cut and dry, because there were a lot of things that he did that can really be described as a matter of fact, there's a there's an official term for it. Some of the listeners out there might know it. It's called Realpolitik. And oddly enough, that is a German way of political thinking, and it's basically the it's an approach in politics that is based on circumstances, and it's also based on, well, whatever the situation is at the time. It's not tied to any particular ideology. It's not really even tied to any ethical or moral premises. It's basically just whatever the exigencies of the day dictate that you do, that's what you have to do. It's the I think it's the lowest common denominator pragmatism or realistic policies that you can follow at any one time. And you see this bear out in a lot of the approaches that he took to supporting a lot of these third world dictatorial regimes that ended up being on the wrong side of the human rights equation. Well, if we just take a look at it, and we take a look at some of the things that Henry Kissinger was at least responsible for recommending, and responsible for responsible for helping orchestrate, you see that there are some good things that he accomplished, but some very questionable things as well, and things that people have harped on him about. But at the same time, the way he was looking at it was, okay, I have to do what I think is pragmatically the best solution for us on our end of the equation, and even if that means making a deal with the devil, he has to, he operates from the framework of sometimes I have to make a deal with the devil in order to do the Lord's work.
Right.
And that's why, and that's one of the things that that's one of the things that spurred him on to do a lot of the policies that he ended up pursuing, or that he ended up recommending. He was responsible for the policy of détente, the Soviet Union. And a lot of people harped on him about that in his later years, and saying, okay, well, you basically were just turning a blind eye to all of the human rights abuses that were happening in the USSR. But the way he looked at it was, okay, well, we just came out of a terrible war in Vietnam. We have fallen behind in the arms race. The Soviet Union ground weapon systems have jumped at least half a generation ahead of ours, détente is really the only thing that we have as an option at this point. Let's adopt a live and let live strategy. Let's do something that's more along the lines of glorified containment. We'll try to talk about some arms reductions on either side, but let's just let them keep doing what they're doing, and we'll keep doing what we're doing, and it will continue to be a bipolar world, at least for the foreseeable future. And he
Yeah.
said, but what we can do, while we're letting the Soviets do what they do, we can take advantage of the Sino-Soviet split, and we can open up relations with China, because China had been closed off from us for a long time. We didn't even have diplomatic relations with them for quite a while. And then it was during Nixon's first term that we were able to normalize relations with Red China, and we saw that really as a strategic foil against the Soviets. They said, okay, well, the communists in Eastern Europe are nobody's friend on the world stage, but if we can make a tenuous alliance, at least a frenemy alliance, with the other biggest, baddest kid on the block, well, normalizing relations with China will make the Soviets think twice about, ever trying to escape the bounds of détente. And not only that, he said, okay, well, if we can defuse the situation in the Middle East with the Yom Kippur War, we'll engage in some
Wow.
shuttle diplomacy there to, try to send some envoys back and forth to defuse the situation as best we can, because we don't want that to become another hot battlefront in this ongoing Cold War. And not only that, let me see if I can negotiate some lasting peace with North Vietnam while we're at it, because a lot of people forget that the Paris Peace Accords, that diplomatic front that ended the Vietnam War, that was actually Henry Kissinger's doing. And that was
Right,
actually
and
how he got the Nobel Peace Prize.
the
Yeah,
America's
and
the
that,
most admired man in America for that, right? That's what he was known as.
yeah, and but at the same time, he was also associated with the escalating bombing in Cambodia, and the involvement in that coup down in Chile back in '73. And also for supporting the Argentinian military dictatorship, and it's and sturdy war there back in the late '70s, early '80s. So he has a mixed record. On the one hand, you can point to some things that he did that had some good downstream effects, but at the same time, he's making these deals with these third world dictators, and he's aligning U.S. interests and U.S. support to people who probably, if given the chance, would want to do us harm, and making alliances with people who stand diametrically opposed to all the American values that we hold near and dear here at home.
It's wild, man. I mean, that's a legacy, huh? I mean, that's a
Yeah.
complicated, complex story of what this man's life was. And when you think about it, when you flee a country and you know what was going on for the Jewish people that in Germany, and he's one and came over here. I wonder how much of that spurred his decision making throughout his life, knowing how bad things can be. And so there's kind of a, there's, yeah, I think that that's got to have affected a lot of what he did, don't you think? Coming
Oh
from Germany. I really do think so.
yeah. I think just given what he was escaping, and in light of what he was running from in Germany, he had seen the worst of it, and he's like, okay, well, yeah. And I think to an extent, that was probably I think Hitler and the Nazis were probably the data point for which he based a lot of his decisions off of, because all things considered, he probably looked at the likes of Allende in Chile and the military government down in Argentina, and probably said to himself, "Well, they're not the nicest people on the block, but at least they're not as bad as Hitler." And I had, firsthand experience, dealing with, seeing what that was like, and seeing all of the human abuse and all of the human rights abuse has gone to the extreme.
Well, yeah, and when that goes to extreme, then you just like whack them out before it gets worse. You know what I mean? It's like, nip it in the bud, kill it off now before the cancer spreads, kind of thing. It's kind of it's understandable and yet not, and it's complicated. It's just complicated. It's one of those things, but it's you can get an understanding of who he is when you think back of where he comes over, and then war hasn't stopped. I don't think there hasn't been a real break, has there, in this country of
No.
going to war? Not really, and I know my mom's cousin Mike, he lucked out during Vietnam. They stationed him in Germany and didn't have anything to do. He just said, "I drank a lot of beer." And I'm going, "Man, you lucked out." And then here's this whole other side, So some people really lucked out and the others didn't, It's God, you got to think, Then re think about with the Berlin Wall. David Hasselhoff wants to take claim to knocking down the Berlin Wall. Remember that? I don't know. Well, you're too young for that. But what is it with David Hasselhoff? Sorry, it's got nothing to do with this show at all, but it's just funny thinking
Well, the
back of,
Germans love him.
I know, man, that's where his biggest albums. Anyway, I really shouldn't laugh because I loved Knight Rider as a kid. I stayed up for that.
Oh, yeah,
I
me
would.
too.
Knight Rider was cool, man. Come on. And now we have cars similar to that. Isn't it wild how this stuff comes true after a while? Mike, it is 2024. What are you looking forward to this year in publishing books? I know more is coming, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Yay.
So
Telltale.
yeah, so yep. Yeah, so let's see. The biggest thing that I'm looking forward to. Well, actually, there are quite a few of them. So there are at least two books that are going to be in the hopper for 2024. One being
Cool.
Red Bandit, and the other being Sarajevo by Dawn.
Ooh.
And yeah, both of those I think are going to be crowd pleasers. At least I hope so.
Two new books. Oh, that would be 27 books? 28? Where are we? I can't keep up. You know I
28,
can.
yeah, that'll be
Hey.
28.
Wow. What's it like feeling being 28? I can't remember. Can't remember. Well, that is awesome, man. We can't wait. Next month, Mike will be back on. He's here every first Monday, and we're going to be looking at Black history. Tuskegee Airmen. We get to finally talk about the Tuskegee Airmen, right? We, you know, and Buffalo Soldier history. We get to talk about Buffalo Soldier history too, right? The Tuskegee Airmen story are just, both of them. I just it's something that has been dear to my heart that I also feel like we need to tell more. There's just so much. Do you find that as a military historian, as a historian, a teacher, and a writer, a speaker, do you feel like we're not anywhere close to actually telling all the stories out there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there is no doubt in my mind that there are so many other stories out there that can be told, so many other stories that need to be told. It's just it really is just a matter
Yeah. Doing it.
of finding, yeah, it's really just a matter of really finding the time and just finding the space to get them all on paper, really.
And telling it well. I mean, that's what you do. I appreciate it because, over the years, I know I've said this on shows, before with you, but it's true. I had no idea that I'd get into military history so much. And I think it's because you come from the people's perspective, the people who fought, and then the people, the families connected, it's human interest stories, even though it's battle and
Yeah.
strategy. And at the same time, I never thought I'd get into battle strategy idea. Like, that's like, you're like, ooh, that's badass over there. Like, you know what I mean? And you have to do that. You have to strategize in life, right? It's still the same thing. We have to strategize what we're doing. You know, it's like if you're going to work, driving to work, maybe you don't want to drive that side of town. You know what I mean? You don't want to, you know what I mean? It's like you have to look at the safety of your family every day, and that's really it, you know? So, I think there's a lot of life lessons in what you do. So we appreciate that. And everyone, keep up with Mike at mikeguardia.com. Get his books on Amazon, all whatever you buy books, bookshop.org. And if he's not in your local bookstore, I'd say go knocking on your bookstore's door. And some of the museums out there, just saying. Like, you know, can you believe we actually did go to the Hal Moore Museum in Bardstown, Kentucky? Remember that day? Nancy and I were calling you on the freeway. Mike, I think, look, he's got his own highway. Hal Moore has a highway, it's his own parkway.
That's
And then
great.
we got to see his house. Like, it was just like unexpected. And it's like, call Mike, call Mike. We're here. And it was awesome it was just a surprise because we didn't even know we were going to be there that day. And it was like, wow, this is super cool. So it's just a special thing. But everyone, Mike Guardia's latest book is Fire in the Hole: Tales of Combat with the 1st Engineer Battalion in Vietnam. So go get it. Thank you so much, Mike, and Happy New Year again.
Okay. Well, thank you, Lisa, and Happy New Year. And yeah, always a pleasure to be on the show. Thank you so much.
Talk soon. Thank you for listening to Big Blend Radio's Military Monday show featuring Mike Guardia, award-winning author and historian. Keep up with Mike and his books at mikeguardia.com. Follow us at bigblendradio.com.